It's 8:14, and I'm King David McKenzie here on Full Blast Friday, and with me here in the studio, brave enough to actually come down and in the middle of the trivia contest and, and show up and do something, we have Reuben James Steindorf and Matt James Shepard, who are involved in a motion picture some of you may have heard of. It's been produced and in fact, is continuing to be produced, right? There's still post-production being done on it. Something called Midian. And now there was a screening of of an early cut.
That's right, yep. Back on October 15th, we had three sold-out shows for the first screener.
And but it was, it is still a work in progress.
That's right, yep. Right as soon as that screener was out, we were right back in the tank, and we're working on it straight through to our next screener now. And then it'll be, we're working on the festival version right now.
Mm-hmm. And which festivals are you looking at taking this to?
Actually, we've got 154 film festivals that we're going to push it to. We've got about 20 that we're actually going to show up to. But the beginning of January, we're going to start putting our press kit together and get it out all over the country. There's usually about a festival on either side of each state, and then they have some condensed festivals like on the either side of the coast. And so there's probably like 8 or 9 festivals in those clusters, and we're going to try to hit every single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a grassroots approach. We'll start with some of the smaller festivals and just kind of work that buzz and get that thing bigger and bigger, and then we'll hit the, because most of the really larger festivals like Sundance and Cannes and stuff, they all take place right around August, and then they'll, you know, toward the winter months, they'll start, you know, in full swing.
Okay. Well, Sundance is usually January, though, isn't
it? But the entry is actually due August 15th.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we got a little, you know, once we get that submitted, once we get that submitted, we have a couple of months to just kind of wait there and twiddle our fingers and then see if they they dig it. Yeah. If they dig it, it's like winning the lottery. I mean, if you get that film into Sundance, they have like 800 entries every year, I guess, and just a handful of them get in.
So, right, or yeah. Telluride or Toronto.
Yeah.
Or,
and there's also a comparative festival like Sundance in the same area that actually goes on at the same time called Slam Dance.
Slam Dance,
which is pretty cool. So we're looking at that, too.
Which wound up having, how I became familiar with that, I'm trying to remember, was it Nick Broomfield, I think? Documentary filmmaker who made a film called Kurt and Courtney about this theory about surrounding the death of Kurt Cobain possibly have been a murder. I won't go into any further details. Go out and you know take a look at the film, and it's been out on video for a while, you know, just take a look at that. And I know that that was originally scheduled for Sundance, and Courtney Love complained about it, and so it wound up getting rescheduled for Slam Dance.
Now, that was when Slam Dance was kind of in its infancy, though, is that correct?
The first 2 or 3 years, I think so.
Okay, yeah. And then it started building, and now it's got equal amount of critics that go to it, and people from Slam Dance are actually getting hailed as much as Sundance. It's starting to even itself out. So the people that don't make it into Sundance, they go right for the Slam Dance.
Yeah,
so,
and Slam Dance at that point was looking for something that would make some noise to say, okay, the game's going to be over here, pal.
Yeah.
Park City, sure, exactly. Okay, yeah.
But yeah, you know, all festivals, I think, you know, once you get them, you know, into these different festivals, it's, you know, getting that word out, getting people to look at it. And so I guess in essence they're all important, but, you know, if we can build enough buzz with some of the smaller ones first, you know, then as we go, some of that buzz will come with us. And
build some momentum, and we'd like to win a few awards, have something to take home, show off a little bit. And then as the buzz, as we are doing now, creating a buzz about the movie, we'll create a backing, and hopefully by the time Sundance hits, they know what we're all about before they even have to look at the movie.
So. Yeah, I've already heard enough about it. Okay, all right, bring it here.
All right, how?
All right, we're good.
Okay, we'll give it a shot.
Okay, how do we get into that particular aspect? Because It is a now Midian is a what I like to refer to as not so much science fiction as speculative fiction.
Correct. Yeah.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
And I guess at the screening there were some people who were not prepared for anything in the world of SF, as it's
referred to. Yeah, I think a lot of people came to this film thinking that they were going to go for something that was, you know, what you would expect from the Midwest, you know, something kind of, feel good. It wasn't, you know, something...
Slice of life from up the street, that kind of thing.
You know, here's what we're doing in the cornfields, and it wasn't really that. You know, it's a war film, you know, and this, you know, the idea here was it wasn't a formula project. It wasn't something where you were supposed to walk away and the good guy, you know, gets the girl and that kind of thing. It was, you know, it was experimental for us as well, but at the same time, we really wanted to have our audience take different things away from it. You know, it wasn't so formula, and that challenge. I think that really upset people.
We did it for the challenge. We didn't do it to insult. We didn't do it to hurt any feelings.
Not at all.
What we did is we wanted people to take notice. This isn't your normal movie. You know, this is something that's...
Right.
You really got to use your imagination. You really see a lot of twists and bumps in the road, some things you won't expect, twists and turns that you're going... When you walk away, you just...
Yeah.
Either
you're not going
to be
in...
Or you're going, holy cow.
You know? Yep, you're not going to be in the middle of the road.
Yeah.
You're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. There's no in-between here. And that's... I think that's our point. That was definitely when I sat down and wrote this, took those 4 months and, you know, really got this thing together. The idea was that I wanted the public to take it in, walk away with something different, but definitely be affected by it.
And it worked.
Yep, and it worked.
Yeah.
Did it work? Yeah. And so we're looking forward to getting this festival version together and bringing it back.
More exciting. Well,
and
we got bigger things going in there too.
There was bigger things definitely.
Yeah. And but at the very least, this is not John Hughes, taking...
Don't bring your kids. It's if you're 18 and above, you know, this is not a family movie. And if you're bringing your children, you're going to be very disappointed. In fact, this time we're gonna actually screen people this time and say, look, you know, this is something that isn't appropriate for children.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It is definitely an adult film.
It's scary. It's gory. There's a lot of swearing, a lot of stuff that kids don't need to be exposed to.
Yes.
That's the bottom line. So please, once again, don't bring kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess we know, one could argue, you know, if you didn't want for your kids to see Blair Witch Project, you probably would not want for your kids to see this one as well.
Definitely.
Would that be a fair comparison?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great comparison. Yeah. It's something, you know, again... it tackles different subjects, I think, that some people are even uncomfortable about. You know, and we are just kind of putting it right in your face. You know, we're putting our own twist on it. Like you said, it's a speculative fiction. You know, it takes it's an environment, a chaotic environment of war. You know, a modern day civil war between a militia and a city government, and you put you put some very extreme personalities in this mix. You know, and a lot of you put them on this roller coaster of events, and you know, it's not going to be something that people, you know, you don't have sedated characters in this film that are restrained. You know, they react with emotion, and there's a lot of intensity in this film.
Mm-hmm. Now the two of you have been involved in commercial production.
That's correct.
Is that okay?
Yep.
That's a totally separate business, but that's how our passion is to get into the film industry, to expand the commercial side, but keep them separate as much as we can.
Yeah.
Because that struck me as, of course, George Romero, when he was making Night of the Living Dead, that was...
His bread and butter.
Yeah. He was for several years after that, he was still continuing to make commercials in...
That's right.
In fact, if you get... the official DVD of Night of the Living Dead, not the cheapos for $5 at
the collector's edition.
Yeah. Yeah.
The
exhausted collector's edition.
Yeah.
Director's version. Yeah.
You can actually, I think there are three or four different commercials on the DVD that he directed as late as 1971.
Wow, that's great.
In Pittsburgh, and also the idea of who's going to make who else would make a horror film in Pittsburgh in 19 67, which is when which is when that thing was filmed.
Well, our commercial production, I think, is a stark contrast to what we're doing here. And I, you go from we're doing some promotions for some very reputable companies, and to put those in the mix, I don't think that's a good idea. You know, it's definitely this is an experimentation, and you know, we're definitely pushing to, you know, get our film career started, and this is our first noble push at it.
But that was where you.
That's
came
where we started.
In
Yep. All of our skills were honed and refined from all the, you know, we've been in the business for 13 years doing commercial production for both regional and national clients. And
just pick up a camera and decide to make a movie. There are some behind-the-scenes skills that went into it. So it is, we do have an advantage over the normal indie filmmaker that, we have some experiences that we can carry over. But those experiences are
some skills, sure.
And what's nice too is that we do have the resources to experiment. It is our budget, is our equipment. There isn't necessarily a time frame that we needed to get it done. But when we did need to make money, we put it on the shelf. And so there were some times where we were on a national TV series for about a year and a half. So the film definitely was shelved during that, where we didn't even look at it. So there was about 3.5 years where. In the interim, where we did not even touch the film, and now, since last September, not this September, but the September before, we said, okay, we're going to get this thing done. So let's go back and let's take a look at what we have, and then let's finish it up. And so we've been hard at it for the last year.
Almost the Orson Welles approach.
Yeah.
the way that he wound up making Othello, I think.
Yeah. What's nice about it is at the end of it, we don't owe
Those
a ton of money to angel investors or anybody out there that might feel like they have a say on the film. That might want us to change it either, At the end of this thing, we own all the equipment. We've done the project, and we haven't lost our shirts.
No strings attached. That's the approach we've had all along. We've had opportunities to maybe snag some money here or do this and that, and attach strings to the project, and we just absolutely refuse to do that.
That's right. Yeah. And for the most part, the only thing that we've accepted from the community, which has been really, really great, is just people. That wanted to be a part of the film and volunteered, their time and energy into just, pulling this thing together with us.
Right.
It started out with 20 people and ended up with 260 people. And so that was the great,
helpful people. In the
Yeah, very helpful La Crosse. People. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. La Crosse is kind of a lot of very generous people,
It wouldn't be the film that it is now without those people.
That's right.
And it went from raw it's shaping up to be one heck of a great movie, and it's gonna be something. So
there's so much to be seen for that third screen. The next screener is gonna be intense. So.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, am I correct? Now, it was primarily or completely shot on video as opposed to.
Not video, digital.
Or digital.
So, yep.
Okay.
So everything that we got, was direct to digital, and then we put it right into the system from there. And now we've got the ability to do all the filters and the treatments to it digitally with all the different layers that we can do to it.
Okay.
So, a lot of treatment goes into the film.
And I would have to imagine that that quite a few people also took notice of that.
Yes. Yep. That was...
At screenings, because... It looks different on projected onto a screen than whatever it would be usually showing at
it's like
theater.
A 35mm print or something to that effect.
Yep.
This was definitely we did it to DVD. It will be printed to film, but for the community, we want to get it out there. We would have to wait several months for a turnaround for something like that.
Right.
We'd like to show the community the progress of this project. Where are we headed? And that's what this first screener was all about, is saying, this is what it is. Thanks for helping us out. And that's what the first screener is. And now the second screener is going to be, this is what it looks like before we get it to the print and we get it sent out to the festivals. But we'll be doing a film print of it, too.
We had quite a few people in Eau Claire that had seen the very first screener, which is, missing a lot of pieces. But the storyline was there, and there was some things intact. There's some people now asking us to bring it to Eau Claire. Let us see it now. We want to see it again. We want to see it. You're hearing a lot of that, which is really neat.
Yeah.
And we did investigate swapping this over, and it's like $30,000. And, we're going to wait for the festival run. Want to get it finished before... I mean, we do that now, then we'd have to do it again. To show it three times to have it to film would cost $90,000 to $100,000.
Right. And as you see the trend, too, a lot of independent films, I think, what was it called, Deepwater? That was shot entirely in digital, open water, shot entirely in digital, and then it was printed to film, and so it got its distribution. So a lot of these independent films now are turning to direct digital, and they're getting them printed directly from there. So
The War Within was also originally.
And so, but the thing is, what's kind of
funny fact, HDNet, their HDNet's film division co-produced that.
Okay. And you know what's interesting too is. These people are using handheld video cameras, and we're talking about mini, you know, the consumer, the prosumer version, and we're using the full size. So it's a definitely a different thing. You know, we're using camera cranes and things. So our, you know, we're working on the aesthetics of the piece too. You know, I think that as far as the flow of the film,
the
art. You know, we're working on perfecting that, and so. You use the full size cameras, you know, the broadcast version, you know, and then you put a direct print to digital, and then from there we'll go to film. But it doesn't have the same kind of grainy effect that a lot of these independent films have these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is actually a very clean looking film.
Yeah, because of the commercial stuff that we have, we're able to use these tools to make things smoother. This camera crane, these, you know, you can get the real size idea of things and events that are happening because you can shoot them from different perspectives, not off the shoulder all the time.
Yep.
Which
So we're pushing, our levels, you know. We're definitely...
Our qualities.
You know, striving to achieve something that's a little bit above of independent films that you're seeing these days. Definitely want it to be something where you go, was this something from Hollywood, or was this something that, you know, that was, you know, like a made-for-TV movie or something, but it definitely not something that looks like it came from your backyard. You know, that's not the idea. You know, it's, anybody can pick up the camera and put it on the shoulder, you know, get the shots, slap something together in 3.5 days and have yourself an independent film. But the idea here
is... And sometimes that will work legitimately,
sure. If it's a good story and you got good performers and, and it's a solid piece, that's great. You know, but this is being approached a definitely different way.
We're trying to take the company approach that we have all the makings of a big budget company without the big budget. So we're just looking for somebody to say, everything you did here was right. Go get yourself everything you need now. Here's a budget. Have fun. You know, that's what we want because this is what it is. It's fun for us.
Yeah, and it's also a showcase of our abilities. You know, we definitely want to show that we can handle large groups, you know, and shoot these different things, and we can add special effects and animations, and you know, that can all
makeup.
Be done in-house. Yeah,
makeup,
and makeup
is in-house. You know, Ruben does all
I do
makeup.
All the makeup, Jack of all trades.
It's great.
Right.
One of those things where, you know, when you're trying to break into the business, too, you want to try to... be experienced in all aspects of the filmmaking process. You know, so that is if you're getting your hands into the makeup or if you get your hands into the sound effects, the next crew that you work with may not be your own crew. It depends on what the project you decide to take on, and will they respect you? Do they, you know, have they seen your work before, and, you know, do you have the ability to step up to the plate and deal with that film and deliver?
I heard people say that the makeup at the movie was it was gross. It was really good, you know. And I told them, "Yo, Ruben did all that." People are just amazed that, you know, it seems like we have 30 people on staff running around taking care of all this stuff. Hey, it's just a couple guys, really.
Yeah, it really just comes down to just two people.
Yeah, a couple guys doing it all.
What kind of lead time was necessary for getting everything prepared before the first shot was made?
Oh, let's see. After the 4 months of writing the script, I think it really came down to, because it was such a smaller concept when I first started, you know, there were 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
It really just came down to securing the locations. You know, we storyboarded out what scenes we wanted to tackle first, the most important scenes, the toughest scenes, and we decided those are the ones we're going to go with. And so we assembled our actors and chose who would fill those parts, and then we went out and we just got our hands dirty, you know, we just got right into it. And so what was kind of nice about doing it too was that we had the freedom. We weren't under a time frame, so we could go out there and we could shoot all day long, and if we didn't like what we had, we'd just go right back at it the next day. And so we just kept doing that,
running the plate till you get it right.
There was no limit of how much film we could shoot. You know, we have hundreds if not thousands of hours of
nobody
film
told us it's got to be done by Wednesday.
You
got to have three quarters of a movie done by Tuesday.
We
enjoyed the process all the way through, and I think a lot of the people that took away some, you know, fantastic experiences from shooting with us, you know, just you never expected suggested you were going to have to, you know, cordon off a neighborhood downtown in La Crosse and ask all the neighbors, you know, can we shoot a, you know, we want to make it look like somebody else's place, you know, so you got all these neighbors hiding in their backyards, you know, peering through the fences going, when are you guys going to be done, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, I think one reference...
Yeah, we want to go to the market.
Come exactly.
On, one reference was made to Ruben that I think he made him retake it a bunch of times, and a lady or somebody hollered from the backyard, slave driver!
I'm known for the, like the 6 or 7 takes. That's great. Let's do it 3 more times.
Hey, that looks really good. Then you do it 7 times. You're like, what happened to the good one? You know?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, just... you know, Kubrick was bad enough. Now you're going to pick up the mantle.
Oh, you know, somebody's got to do it. You know,
dirty, filthy, that's... thankless job. But yeah. You know, somebody's got to roll up the sleeves.
Crazy
and
tell you how wonderful your
I got a tough skin. I can handle that.
5 more times.
But, you know, what's funny about the film, too, is that we were able to make this modern-day Civil War right here in La Crosse, and not once did we ever have the cops called on us. You know, there were, you know, we blew up a lot of major landmarks, and I never had anybody go, I see a smoke cloud in the distance or anything. You know, it was all digital, and we were able to pull this off.
Which would have been particularly interesting, considering that, if I remember correctly, we are talking about a municipal civil war.
That's right. Yep.
Context.
Yep. We have, basically, it all started in the city government. You know, this ideal city, one of the safest in the country, you know, it really revels in these strict laws and these taxations and early curfews, zero noise pollution. And then you have the reformists, we call them, the younger ones that come in. You know, after you have the grandfathers of the city that really, you know, built the city and made it a solid society. Now you have people going, well, maybe we don't want to do it that way. Maybe we want to try another approach. Well, you know, that didn't fly with them. So they ended up, you know, forming the census and sending it out to all these citizens and to see what they were thinking. And they took drastic steps. The ones that they didn't think that were the ideal citizen or in line with their ideas, they wanted them out. And what happens is the city divides right from the city government, divides in half. And that trickles out to the citizens, and the citizens become outraged by what's going on. And before you know it, you have two basically, you have two warring factions right in the same town. And it starts out with some military exercises that get out of hand. And before you know it, you do have, it goes from what we call kind of a suburban Cold War or a domestic Cold War to a full-out modern-day Civil War.
In a municipal context as opposed to some foreign...
Right. Yep. There was. Yeah. And what's interesting, though, talking about the foreign thing, you know, we have foreign interests. You know, this is a multicultural interest that happens here. We've got this civil war that's happening, and war is industry. And you know, the convention of war and you know, bringing in, you know, you have to build the tanks, you have to build the choppers, you know, you have to hire the soldiers, and you have to feed them, you know. So there's a lot of industry that is suddenly focused in on this one, you know, location in the United States. And so now foreign interest starts to come in and goes, hey, well, we could build your tanks and we could build your choppers. And before you know it, you have yourself this melting pot from 50,000 population in the size of La Crosse. Now overnight becomes 3 million people, and it's like a mini New York. And so there is foreign interest at the end, you know, and it kind of spreads out over the country, you know, as sort of a idealist virus, and becomes very virulent. And you have now, you know, people contributing. People are actually giving up their jobs to come and work for Minion. You know, there's great pay in you know, being a 9-to-5 soldier. And so that's where this thing is.
Social fortune kind of deal.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's not a weekend thing. It's a 9-to-5 job, 5 days a week. You know. And then the laws are, you know, in order to keep this war at a steady pace that we can control as a nation. You know, because they're really just testing this militia to see, you know, what their tactics are. And the idea is that they needed to put these rules to it to spread it out to keep it under control. Otherwise, it could have been. You know, a thermonuclear blast in there or some weapon of mass destruction that would have wiped this whole thing out and caused, you know, utter chaos. Rather, they turned it into an industry. And so you have this 9-to-5 war. So after 5 o'clock, all the machines shut down. You're not able to, you know, fire your weapons. you have to return to civilian status. And the same people that you're battling are your neighbors. And so, mm-hmm. you know, it's we referred to it.
So it's not a something like the bed sitting room where there's so much chaos going on after the aftermath of a war.
You know, this is required to be civil.
This is one where after 5 o'clock, it's almost like the Warner Brothers cartoon, between the coyote and the sheepdog. Sure, yeah.
It's like a controlled fire. Yep. You think you got it under control.
See you tomorrow,
sometimes
Ralph.
Sometimes
right.
you don't.
Yeah.
Punch the clock. I'll try to kill you tomorrow. I can't.
Like a sheep. Yeah.
Oh, you got away from me today.
They're both by the time cock. Mm-hmm.
Want to go fishing this weekend?
Sure.
There's a lot of things that we could have touched on in the film, and this thing could have been a 6-hour movie, but we chose to take the backstory and make that very poignant in the beginning, and to spread some of those bits of information throughout the film. But it was actually very focused on what it does to a handful of people. A handful of those people are in power, and also some of the people that are basically peons. They're the the foot soldier, the chopper pilot. And this story is supposed to, it really takes you into this environment, shows you how terrible it is, and then some of the byproduct of it are the citizens and how they cope with that. You know, can you be a 9-to-5 soldier and then be a family man afterward? Mm-hmm. So that was something I was exploring as I wrote the script, was can you achieve a balance between being a warrior and
there's so much reference to work. People take their work home. Get mad, upset because something didn't happen at work. You know, what are the same effects if this is actually war? Do you go home and hate your neighbor and pick fights, or can you be civil?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how you want to stress the
human psyche. We kick it up a few notches with intensity.
you want to challenge the human psyche,
your extra
see what
calibers.
The capabilities are. Some people probably could do that, go home and not care, but some people can't. And that's just a plain fact. So,
And this thing just unfolds, as you go. There's a lot of reveals, and it is the darkest hours of our main characters' lives, and that is not something you can smooth over. And there are no niceties in a chamber like that. When you're in that kind of a situation, politeness is out the door. You're going to use the words that you use, and that was one of the things that we were getting a lot of feedback. A lot of flack was.
Did they live? I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't think anybody was cared about what happened to these characters, and
all of these four-letter words.
Yeah, profanity was. Yeah, it was intense, and for the festival version, some of that is toned down, but we're not making any apologies for what these characters are going through and how they respond to that. The fun thing that we were able to experience in actually shooting some of this stuff is we gave our actors devices and said, this is what your character does, this is their limitations, this is what you need to get through these scenes. And we did that with each of them. We broke it up. So it almost became sort of a, it was this condensed competition to get through your scene and to work off of other people to get your... to get to your point, what was your destination with that scene? So we gave each person their specific destinations, put them in the room, it's all scripted, but at the same time, they don't know how the other one is going to necessarily respond to that. So we gave them devices that would cripple the other one from achieving that. And that's where a lot of the profanities, I think, came out of,
it was frustration.
They were mad because, we would tell one actor, we would say, okay, this is the information you have, but you're not going to give it to them. No matter what you do, you're not going to give it up, all right, until you hear this, And so then we go to the other guy and say, okay, you're just going to, just keep railing on him until he gives you that information, and then we'd give him his devices and some of the things that he knew. You put those two together, and you get some very interesting stuff.
Okay.
It's on the job training in improvisation.
Yes. And so these people, and we built one of our sequences, we call the chamber. It took a lot of money on my part to pull it all together because we had to fly all the actors back in, we had to build the sets and everything, but we had a very limited time with them for that scene because it was so important, yet that we were pulling these people away from their day jobs. And so we had 48 hours to shoot, I think it was 32 scenes. and we had to get, you know, to a point with each of those. So it took us to, you know, basically we lived and died in this chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And we used this, yeah, on the job training of improvisation.
Yeah, not a written script. So this came from
the hearts of these people. Yeah, they were really in it. Yeah. And they were in pain, too, because we would hold, you know, we didn't feed these people during this time, you know. So, I mean, they were very mad.
Where's the boxed lunch? At least, at least the mill got the people.
You know, and these people were required to, and they were troopers, you know, and my hat's off to these three, you know, actors of ours. But, you know, we put them in the makeup, and we put them in very uncomfortable situations, and they were, you know, from the get-go all the way to the end, they were troopers. And that was probably one of the most amazing parts of this project for me, was to experience that, what these people, we walked out of there, we hated that set. You know, we hated the experience, but we walked away and go, wow, that changed us.
It worked.
Yeah.
And each one of the three characters go through something different that's dynamic. Yeah. One's looking for revenge, the other guy's kind of...
We don't want to give too much of that away, but, you know, but
what's going on, the other's missing his family. I mean, you know, there's three different total emotions like any normal human
that's
beings would go through.
Yeah, mm-hmm. When I talked to some veterans as I was writing the script, they told me, you know, what's interesting about war as well, when you are in the thick of it, you are forced to become friends out of necessity in order to survive with people you wouldn't normally become friends with. And in this sense, we have three very diverse characters that would never talk to each other in any, you know, it would take tremendous effort to get them in the same room, you know, in order to, you know, to get to know each other, and nothing would come of it. But when you tell them that they're going to die, you know, get along.
Yeah,
you know, it's a different story, you know.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you love everybody.
Yeah. Got to really make do,
Or you just, you know, and one of our taglines is, you know, in the darkest hours of your lives, when you know you're going to die, some people prepare to die while others are making plans. And so the concept here is that you have three people that are learning what their destinations are, what their fate is going to be, and who they are, and the importance of their roles, and how you're going to handle that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not a whole lot of people will go through this life not knowing what the point was. You know, and these guys are unfortunately faced with it. You know, they got the mirror right in front of them.
Right.
So.
Try to get the remainder in maybe about 5 minutes or so. There's a website.
That's right.
With some materials on it, right?
Yep. It's alienglaive.com, and that is being consistently updated. Again, that's alienglaive.com.
ALIENGLAVE.
GLAIVE.
GLAIVE.
Yep.
Okay.
And don't get that mixed up. It's not it's not a movie about aliens. That's the name of the film company. It's alienglaive.com.
Where'd you come up with that one?
Well, actually, when we got this whole thing rolling, I think right around the time I started my production company, commercial production company, I was working on some treatments, and one of the concepts was this alien civilization that was living underneath La Crosse in the irrigation tunnels that we have from way back when they had to heat the city with hot water. And so... They decided to do a little excavating to see what's under there, and they unleashed this hive of burrowing aliens, and they attacked the city, and that was where I came up with the name for that. So that was my first treatment on a film, Alien Glaive. And so we kept it.
By any chance, did you have them, were you planning on and having them resemble alligators? Like in New York, what I've heard?
No, nothing like that. It was, you know, it was just something that we tried back then, and the name stuck, and I really dug the name, so we kept it.
Now, where we found Igor?
Yeah. in our last screener, just to put another thing in there about the film, was, you know, we've got a guy that has been hailed as the second tallest man in the world, and he's in this film. And he was an amazing trooper. We put him under 6 hours of makeup. And the guy, you know, he kind of hated me afterward, but I think he likes me now. But, we really wanted to take this, you know, larger-than-life character in our story, and we found the guy to fit the position. And now he... we're working on all the effects with him. You know, the guy's walking around with rocket launchers and these big spider tanks, and it's intense stuff.
Larger than life stuff.
And by name, we're talking about?
Yeah, Igor Vovkovinsky.
From the Ukraine.
Yep, from the Ukraine.
Hmm.
And
we bought him a 6X Midian shirt and it didn't fit.
Nope. It needed to be a tall. We got him a regular.
7X tall.
It's got a midriff, guys. It ain't pretty.
It's pretty sad if you can go to the big and tall store and they don't have things to fit you. You're too big.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty huge.
But he was, he was great to work with. He was a pleasure to work with. We hope we can work with him again very soon. So he'll be there for the screener. He's a real nice guy. So
we have some stuff coming into the Tribune. Maybe we're going to try to get a letter to the editor out.
Yep.
We'll be on more radio stations, and then we'll throw a commercial in there.
Yep, we got ourselves a 60-second commercial that's probably going to be debuting, I would say, middle of November, and there will actually be some specific dates for that on the alienglave.com site.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and also the commercial will also perhaps be on the site as well?
We'll take that once we get it rolling.
In a WMV file or a reel file?
Go right to the website and you'll be able to pop it right up. And it will be the same thing you get to see in local.
Right. Here's my bit of a disclaimer. I shot a couple of scenes for that.
And he was just a pleasure to work with.
Fill your hands.
Such a dramatic creature.
Yeah, are my shots remaining in?
Well, we were kind of batting them across the room, I caught it before it shattered, and you're in there.
We're working it out. It's going to be great. We do want to say once again, thank you to LaCrosse. 3 sold-out shows. That's incredible.
That is amazing. Yep.
We're going to work with you guys, and we love you. Thank you. Thanks, and everybody.
Much love.
Yeah, definitely. Reuben James Steindorf and Matt James Shepherd. Once again, Alien Glaive Productions.
Yeah, AG Films, alienglaive.com is the website. Check it out. We'll see how many hits we get.
Yeah. And it's been climbing.
We'll let you know.
And, we'll finally see exactly how many people do listen to this show anyway.
Yeah.
So, in any event, we are talking about right now, it's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Here's a...